Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and our special guest today is Dr. Robert Kleinhens. Dr. Kleinhens is the chief economist at the Los Angeles County Economic Development Corporation, the LAEDC. Dr. Kleinhens directs the Kaiser Center for Economic Research, which conducts research on regional, state, and national economies. He's also been a teacher for over 25 years, and we have had him as a guest before, and we welcome him back. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Bruce. It's great to be on the program.
When you're in the kind of looking forward business, I thought we might start with 2014 and say what, when you looked at the beginning of 2014 and then compared to how it ended, were there any surprises?
Well, I think many of us expected when looking at the overall economy that 2014 was going to be strong from start to finish. As we know, looking at the national numbers like GDP, we got off to a bumpy start, not unlike what has happened here in 2015, but a particularly bumpy start in the beginning of 2014 that tempered the economic outcome for all of the year 2014. I'll say this, though. We went through a major revision of the job numbers at the beginning of this year, looking back at 2014 and some of the prior years, and we had a very pleasant surprise that there were some very large upward revisions in job counts for the state of California, for LA County, for the U.S. as well, all of which sort of retroactively told us that 2014 turned out to be a fairly good year as far as the economy is concerned, a good year as far as the labor market is concerned. The big issue looking back on 2014 and now looking ahead through 2015 and 2016 is when will wage growth kick in a substantial way so as to increase the incomes of middle-income households?
When we have an oil price change like we did, and I don't remember exactly the months that that took place, but it dropped by over half, and there would have been monthly savings, at what point does the consumer actually begin to say, I can spend that extra money and almost count on it's going to be a permanent deduction from my budget?
Well, so, I mean, going back to your previous question, I agree with you that the plunge in oil prices and gasoline prices in 2014 was a big, positive, unexpected event. Some people, I think, anticipated it. It was maybe a slow-moving train coming that accelerated in the year 2014. So to answer your question, I do think that people still aren't quite sold on the idea that gasoline prices, which I think more directly affect people here locally than oil prices, and I don't think very many people here in Southern California rely on heating oil, but so gasoline prices being as low as they are, the question is, will those low prices be sustained for some period of time? And you're right, if they think it's going to be sustained for a longer period of time, then that's going to figure back into their budgeting, and some of that money that's freed up because they don't have to spend as much on gasoline, they'll be able to spend on other things, they'll be able to use it to pay off credit cards and so on and so forth. So I think people are still trying to size things up. The experts are saying that we're looking at a period of low oil prices for at least the next 5 years, and as recently as yesterday, OPEC has come out with an analysis that suggests that they don't think that oil prices are going to cross the $100 mark for perhaps another 15 years. I think that's very stunning news.
It is. Probably, I guess it would be probably pretty inaccurate because of who knows what. But, you know, what's interesting is that I don't recall any of them saying in advance that we're going to see a 50% cut in oil. So I think that kind of surprised them. And by the way, the reason I brought that up at the time I did after you talking about jobs was while we wait for wage growth, anything that increases net spendable income is almost exactly the same, except for if it's viewed as temporary versus permanent.
Right. Well, so, I mean, that's a very good point. And that's why I think households are still sizing up whether or not this decline in gasoline prices is permanent. And so we need to add a couple of things to this calculus, if you will. Going back historically several years, even before the recession, the typical household income has essentially been flat, if not declining, against inflation. So putting it differently, purchasing power has actually been falling for the typical household for many years, even before the recession. So the decline in gas prices has given them a respite. And you're right, they're going to turn around and spend some of that money that they otherwise would spend at the gas pump on other things, goods, services, paying off credit cards, maybe, you know, financing a car. Although I don't think that the typical household is going to see that much in monthly savings on a monthly basis to warrant that type of change in expenditures. But we haven't really seen an increase in consumer spending that many experts thought would come around as a result of the declining gas prices.
Well, what's interesting about that, too, is let's say for the last, it's hard to say this, 35 years since I've been sort of an adult that's kind of known what's going on, we've enjoyed ever-decreasing costs of interest rates. So when I borrowed money on a residence in 1981 to become an investor, I refied it at 17.5. And now if I refied it, it would be 3 and change. And the cost of financing, if that's cheap, it also equates to more net spendable income. What happens when that chart starts to go in the other direction? How do you maintain GDP growth in the light of having ever more expensive borrowing of money?
So at the time you were borrowing money at 17%, inflation was also in double digits or close to it. And so, and also in many instances, wages were growing a lot faster than they are right now. But you're absolutely right. We look at the prospects over the next few years, and we have to figure that interest rates are going to go up, not down. Inflation is expected to be fairly low, but even so, interest rates going up from what are essentially rock bottom rates, whether you're looking at 30 years ago versus today, or even 50 years ago, we really haven't seen rates this low in many decades, and it's fueled some spending. Although I think both a lack of business and consumer confidence has held that spending back, there's unless we see wage growth in the face of higher interest rates, we have to be concerned about how the economy is going to grow over the next couple of years. I don't mean to be doom and gloom. I'm just saying that this is something that we need to be mindful of.
Does raising minimum wages create a domino effect for other wages?
I think the evidence on that is mixed, and if you take a look at what often precipitates the interest in raising minimum wage, it's usually a desire to improve the lot of low-income households, and many think that as opposed to a minimum wage, doing more with the earned income tax credit at the federal level is a way to ameliorate low-income household problems.
Okay. As far as United States and California in the oil world, oil shale, is California a fairly large participant in the creation of oil as either something we use or export?
Well, I think we're one of the top five producers. I don't have those numbers exactly in hand at the present time, but we're among the largest producers as a state of oil production here in the United States, Texas, of course, being the largest. I have a hunch that it's South Dakota that is second, and we're like third or fourth. As far as whether shale oil predominates or what percentage of shale oil production and fracking we're engaged in here in California versus other places, I don't have those numbers top of mind, but I would just point out that we've probably been seeing fracking take place across the state for many decades. That's my understanding from talking to people in the oil industry.
On the subject of water, that seems to be kind of have risen to the top of the list as far as concern. And what's your take on water and its possible ramifications for the economy of California?
Yeah, I think the near-term impact on the overall economy is kind of muted. So first off, we want to take a look and see how fresh water is used in the state of California. About half of it goes to environmental uses. And then the remaining half that you could say is used by humans, about 80% of that is used for agriculture. So the remaining 20% is used in cities for both residential and non-residential uses. We've already seen that agriculture in the state of California has been hit, having to take acreage out of production because of reductions in water and so on. But agriculture accounts for maybe 3% or so of the total workforce and maybe 2.5% of gross state product. So its impact of, you know, shrinkage due to the drought is very limited. Its general impact on the economy is very limited. I think the longer-term question is, will water scarcity affect communities' ability to engage in new residential development and so on, given that we've got to assume that they got to get water from somewhere. And
right.
If they can't, then our ability to build new housing may be compromised at some point in the future. It's just not clear how far out that future happens to be.
Okay. Yeah, that was my next question. Population growth in California, when we talk about just the migration game, we used to have, going back into, let's say, the 70s and 80s, we used to have a really positive on both sides. We used to have a lot of net migration coming from other states and as well as immigration. And how has that changed now?
Well, there was a huge change, of course, that occurred back in the 1990s because we went through both the defense cuts and a bunch of other restructuring in our California statewide economy that many other parts of the country didn't have to go through. So we saw a huge exodus happen in the 1990s to other parts of the country. And you have to ask, well, is that the same sort of thing? Did that same sort of thing happen during the Great Recession that just ended a few years ago? And the answer is no, because a few years ago when we experienced the recession, so did the rest of the country. So, in fact, we saw migration really slow down dramatically. Some of the migration counts were the lowest in decades. To your point, we've seen a resumption of population growth. It really didn't slow down, but it did. It didn't go negative, but it did slow down a bit. We've seen a resumption of population growth. We're still seeing a slight out migration to other states, and that's more than offset by an in-migration of international population here to the state of California. And by the way, most of the regional migration is from county to county. So the L.A. County migration numbers, we find that when you look at the domestic out-migration, most of the people who are leaving L.A. County are moving to Riverside, San Bernardino, and Orange County, with a smaller number of people going to places like Clark County, Nevada, Mariposa County, Arizona. I don't remember the names of the counties up in Oregon. But most of the migration that's taking place in Southern California is county to county.
Does that have something to do with the cost of housing?
It definitely does.
Okay.
So we know that, if you will, the affordability safety valve for Southern California is the Inland Empire. And to a lesser degree, it's also places within Los Angeles County, such as the Antelope Valley. So what we tend to see is that out-migration ramps up as affordability falls.
Like you said, LA really does lose a fair amount of domestic migration to to local areas, but they have very strong immigration. If you had to give me the resume of the person that shows up in LA County from other countries, can you give me an idea of who they are and how would they differ from the people that showed up to Orange County?
Boy, that's a tough question. I don't really have that information top of mind, Bruce, but I mean, I think that you've probably got to paint at least a couple or three different pictures because, yes, you might have someone who arrives in Los Angeles County, maybe from Point South, who has less of an education and is willing to take on just about any kind of job that's available. And whether that person is legal or illegal, regardless, that's the kind of the profile. Then you also find that this is an attractive place for people from all over the world, people who have education, have income, and we know that there's a demand nationally for people, particularly in some fields of engineering, IT, and so on, that we have a visa program that is available to accommodate those kinds of people with those kinds of backgrounds because the number of people we have coming out of our grad schools and so on is in short supply. So we have a number of people who are international migrants who don't fit that stereotype that many people think of when they think of an international immigrant coming here to Southern California.
When the Japanese economy boomed in the 80s for them and the stock market exploded in value, a lot of money showed up from the Japanese to the United States and kind of pushed the prices for commercial real estate and for residential as well. The China market, the stock market's exploded this year. The real estate market's been in play for any number of years. And we have a fair amount of people bringing money into China. Are we concerned about their economy changing and the ramifications that might have here?
Well, I would make an observation, draw an analogy, actually, between China's economy and the experience of Japan. You'll find that if you look at projections of population for China, that before too long, they're going to be seeing a decline in population, and at some point, they'll be overtaken by India in terms of their population counts. When you have an economy with a declining population and an aging population, you are looking at a scenario that's very much like the scenario that Japan faced. If we start in the 70s and 80s, as you point out, they were already anticipating that their economy, the demographics were going to be such that they were going to be looking at an aging population. And so if they wanted to grow and they wanted to see growth in their overall economy, they had to look outside their economy to do so. So that's part of the reason, aside from the fact that they had a lot of dollars because of their trade surplus, it's part of the reason why they invested heavily here in Southern California, bought up big parts of downtown Los Angeles, if you recall.
Right.
So, let's shift forward to the early 21st century where we are right now, and I think it's certainly another period of time where another country is looking at its own demographics. It wants to grow. It wants to raise the standard of living for its residents. And it has a large trade surplus with the United States. So it does seem to make sense that we'll see over the next few years an increased level of investment coming from China into the United States.
What do you think the net effect to California will be if we get immigration reform?
Well, we haven't had a chance to study that in depth, but I would say that one of the main industries that will likely be affected would be agriculture. So as I said earlier, it doesn't account for a large segment of the economy. It's not a large segment of the workforce, but the fact is that it is one of the largest sectors that exports, not just to the rest of the world, but, we are America's farm basket in many ways, and we export or send a lot of our produce and other agricultural commodities and products to other parts of the country. Immigration reform probably would be first and foremost be affecting agriculture here in California. And if it can be turned into, I don't know what form immigration reform will take, but if it could be turned into some sort of a sensible approach that recognizes the reality of people who are here right now, and also acknowledges that some key industries need to have migrant workers to conduct their business and figure out a rational way to accommodate that, then I think that'll be better for the California economy.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, the most conservative people, I don't know how many people we're talking about in California, but I doubt that they would all want them to go home and vacate whatever position they have and the rental or ownership of the homes they have. We probably would see a very negative impact very quickly.
Yeah, it's there. This is an integral part of our workforce and our economy, and so and perhaps more so than most of the other states around the country. Although, I think I'd make the observation that here in the early 21st century, we have a lot of other states that rely more heavily on migrant workers and international migration, and it will be in the interest of many residents in many of the states around the country to get this worked out. I would also point out, as I mentioned earlier, that there are some skilled workers that we bring into the United States under quotas, and some sort of revision to that part of immigration reform will also be necessitated, because that's constrained our ability to grow some of our faster growing industries, which are really going to be a part of our 21st century economy going forward.
Can you see a day in the near future where we load all the crops onto diesel trucks that don't have any drivers?
Well, that's a great question. The ports, of course, are another area where you've got a lot of goods movement on vehicles, and one of the things that they're doing down in the Port of Long Beach with the new Middle Harbor project is the plan is that they're going to have driverless vehicles, essentially driverless trucks that are also electric. And so not only will they be emission-free, but they're also going to be automated. And, you know, for certain kinds of uses, I think that we're probably going to see, I didn't come up with this, but I think it's safe to assume that we're probably going to see driverless vehicles in commercial applications before we see them running around town taking kids to school and stuff like that. So household use is probably going to come second after it's been tested in the commercial arena.
Yeah, I've been fascinated. I really thought it was, I don't know, a long ways away. I have a friend, Sean O'Toole from Property Radar, and he's always up on all this stuff, and he mentioned that to me, and I thought, oh, you gotta be kidding. So I looked it up, and sure enough, the coal industry is already those massive gigantic trucks already being driven around by themselves, you know.
Yeah, it's so one of the interesting questions that comes up is that IT technology, artificial intelligence, is, you know, permeating just about every aspect of our economy in big ways, in transformational ways, that being the idea of a driverless vehicle being just one up-and-coming technology. And you have to ask the question, well, at some point, is this going to mean that people won't have to work anymore, that machines are going to do the work of all people? I think we're a long, long ways away from that, but some people have raised that possibility. But I think it's pretty remote at this point, not in our lifetimes.
You know, it's interesting. I never would have thought that was potentially going to take a piece of the workforce out of that job, but I guess that's a possibility. We've run out of time for this segment. We've been joined by Robert Kleinhens, the chief economist of the LAEDC. And Robert, we welcome you. We'll look forward to talking to you on our next segment.
Very good. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.